I should perhaps say a few things about myself to indicate my where I have expertise and where I don't, because I don't know how you feel about it, but I kind of get rather irritated by scientific colleagues who become pompous about all sorts of things way outside their own sphere of expertise. So, you know, I can't promise not to be pompous, but I will tell you where my narrow expertise begins and ends. So I started off as a physical scientist, got interested in how the brain works through some lectures of someone whose name will be known to many of you, and a few of the older ones would have known personally, Donald Mackay, and so became a neuroscientist. My work as a neuroscientist was on quite prosaic things like how the brain moves or rotates the eyes and how it uses visual information to do that. And I've also worked on some issues to do with how sensory information regulates the growth of the eye and some other matters I don't need to tell you about. So I know quite a lot about vision and simple motor control in the brain. I'm not a neuropsychologist, and I couldn't pretend to be an expert about things like which bits of the brain are more important for our emotions, though I have done a little bit of work on that. I'm also not at all a molecular person, and I'm not a geneticist. So I'm what's called a systems neuroscientist whose main interest has been looking at the link between behavior of a whole organism, typically humans or non-human primates in my case, and what is going on amongst the nerve cells that one has some anatomical grounds for thinking play a role in the behavior concerned. I understand you're a group of people, mostly with a Christian commitment, who are interested in science, but I will try to talk in such a way that I'll be accessible to people who either have another faith commitment or none at all. Now, those of you who've read C.S. Lewis might be aware of this fairly well-known quote, which is kind of a sort of very pointed attack on what he called naturalism, what many commentators would call scientism nowadays. What the naturalist believes is that the ultimate fact, a thing you can't go behind, is a vast process in the space of time that's going on of its own accord. Now, one of Lewis's arguments about why that had to be wrong went as follows. And this follows various predecessors, including the hell-raising geneticist, J.B.S. Haldane. No thought can be valid if it can be fully explained as a result of irrational causes. If my mental processes are determined wholly by the motions of atoms in my brain, I have no reason to suppose that my beliefs are true, and hence I have no reason for supposing that my brain is composed of atoms. So I actually think that that's very a very striking statement. There's some truth in it, but I think there's also muddle in it, although it has its modern defenders, particularly Alvin Plantinga. So I think it's certainly true that you can't draw a valid scientific conclusion unless in some sense your thinking is valid. So the hardline materialist who thinks that there's no such thing as thinking is in a difficulty in describing what science is about, it seems to me. I'm much more doubtful about the second statement, which is the validity of our thinking has to depend on independence. And that is, in a sense, one way of putting the nub of this issue. Is a mechanistic account, what's going on inside us, compatible with, if you like, the common sense view of ourselves as individuals who make judgments, choices, and decisions that are to some extent free. Now, those of you who have looked at philosophy at this will know that there's a time-honored way of subdividing views about the free will issue, and that's to say there are two dimensions here. Do you think we have free will or not? And do you think that the universe we live in is deterministic? And the labeled positions are called compatibilism. If you think it's a deterministic universe and you have free will, materialism or something like it, if you think that there's no free will and it's a deterministic universe. Libertarianism, if you think that we have free will and no determinism, and free will is impossible for other reasons. Now that's a cartoon. Just to indicate how big a cartoon it is, those of you who are well read in your Protestant reformers will know that there's a famous debate between Luther and Erasmus, where Luther writes a pamphlet called The Bondage of the Will, in which he is making the standard reformer's point that man is a wretched sinner and unable to save himself, and it is entirely through God's grace that it's possible for us to get out of that state. And that led Luther to deny free will to the unconverted. And Erasmus said, remember, lots of reasons in the Bible for thinking that's rather too crude a statement. And Luther jumped on him in his typical way, you know, just hammering away at the main point. So to make a more fundamental point, anyone with a high view of God's sovereignty will want to say that there is a sense in which nothing happens that is outside of God's creative will. So there are some interesting things in here from a theological point of view. And of course, different theologians take different views. But that's not our subject tonight, so I'm just mentioning that. Now, to go down to a very, very commonsensical level, let's not worry about the high-flown issues. I remember having a conversation with one of my medical students because I was responsible for teaching science to medical students for some years. And I expressed concern about the amount of money spent in the bar and what it implied about how much people were drinking. And the point was made to me is, Dr. Judge, this is stupid. The people who have problems with drink have already got their problems with drink. They're a hopeless case. And most people don't have a problem, and they won't get a problem. So there's no point doing anything about prices in the bar and all the rest of it. Now, I'd say that's a kind of incipient soft determinism, that there's a way of thinking about people which is they're in the clutches of addictions or their past influences or their inner nature. And that's quite corrosive. So I would want to stress from a practical point of view that if we think of ways in which external and internal factors affect people's behavior, the thing we need to remember is that no one is an individual on an island. Actually, we're all potentially under the influence of other people. And so that puts a kind of constraint on the extent to which some of the problems about the effects of history and the effects of our nature are completely determined. So that is by way of a kind of very simple-minded introduction. And I want to now say a number of things which really fit under the heading, I actually don't think that we're very free. I think, if you like, the older view that humans are mostly doing things that are unconstrained is probably not true. If you think of a slave, many people have been slaves in human society, they weren't free. Our genetic inheritance certainly has effects on at least some of us. Our upbringing has an effect. Train up a child in the way it should go, or don't. The norms under which we live. Fashion. Just stand back a minute and think how many of the things we actually do are determined by fashion, even in church. What music do we sing? Is it the same as we sung 20 years ago? Well, some things are fashionable, some things aren't. So, I think there's a lot of constraints, and that in some ways the practical question is not the binary question, are we free or are we not, but what kinds of intervention at what level are effective and appropriate. Now, I want to make very clear I'm not a materialist. Of course, it would be surprising if I was as a Christian, though there are so-called Christian materialists. And one of the reasons I'm not is I don't see how you can be a scientist unless you think that there are observers who can make valid observations, communicate them, make inferences from them. And none of those things are definable in terms of the nuts and bolts of mechanistic science. You know, it doesn't, strictly speaking, make any sense to talk about a nerve cell making an observation or making an inference. You might mean something like that nerve cells can be part of realizing a process of which the whole organism view is making inference, but to ascribe these kind of things to anything short of a human being or something like it is very doubtful. So I agree with Lewis in some sense, which is, if there's nothing to us but the nuts and bolts, and I would see the nuts and bolts in terms of neurons, not atoms, then there are no observations, no inferences, and no science. Where I would disagree with Lewis is I don't think that means that we need immaterial parts in quite the same sense Lewis did. But we do need, if you like, the abilities expressed above.
Could you look at that slide again? Because yes, you were standing, you just moved on, man. Because you were standing in front.
Apologies.
Of
okay. Maybe I need to move this back. Now, I'm going to talk about a very classic experiment. And the experiment some of you have heard of. It's associated with the name of a surgeon called Benjamin Libet. And the task is very simple. You ask a subject to press a button and to press it when they feel like it. Okay, so, and to do it many times, but not on any particular set pattern. So there are various ways you could set up the experiment. So here you are, you're pressing the button when you feel like it. And they're doing it a lot of times, and the reasons would become clear. So, if you were a dualist, you'd say that at some point before each press, the real you, the mental you, if you like, makes a decision, and that is then conveyed to the apparatus that moves your arm in your brain. Now, if you like that way of doing it, there's a particular part of the brain that would be one of a number of reasonable candidates, and that's up here in the front, in the midline, and it's called the supplementary motor cortex. And Jack Eccles, who won the Nobel Prize for neuroscience some years ago, proposed this. So he was a dualist, and he said that there in the supplementary motor cortex was where non-material mental decisions could influence the brain. And the reason we might not be able to observe that was that these effects were below the limit of quantum indeterminacy. Now, other people have advocated that since then, but Eccles was the earliest I'm aware of, and he first put forward these ideas about 60 years ago. Now, this is not inherently unreasonable. Here's a famous experiment, and I'll just come down a bit so that I can... So this is an early type of brain imaging. This is a sketch of a human brain. And what has happened here is the subject has been breathing radioactive noble gas, so it's chemically innocuous, and it's a small dose of radioactivity, and it's chosen to be one that is conveyed by metabolically active, more active bits of the brain. And when you ask someone to flex a finger, then what lights up is this part here on the side of the middle of the brain, where we know from lots of experiments there's apparatus that is concerned particularly with movements of the fingers, and then further out it's concerned with other parts of the body movement. Now, if you ask people to do something more complicated, like imagine, like play a little ditty, then what you get is both that primary motor area and this supplementary motor area on the midline and down inside the medial face. But here's the wonderful thing that Roland and Al found, if you just ask people to imagine playing a little ditty, they're not actually doing it, and you can put electrodes on to check that, then you still get the supplementary motor cortex light up. And there are other observations about that area of the brain to suggest that it's doing something complicated involved in preparation in some general sense for executing an action. So now to go a little bit further to the particular experiment, and I apologize for people actually know this experiment. So in the 1960s, a German neurologist discovered that if you stick a little metal disc up here on the brain and have a reference electrode far enough away that it's not affected by the brain, and look at the potentials, you know, there's a little bit of, you know, all the buzzing of the billions of neurons in the brain create very small signals neuron by neuron, but together you actually get enough electrical activity that is detectable outside the skull. And that's called the electroencephalogram. So if you record that scalp signal while someone is doing this task of pressing a button, just whenever they feel like it, you can't see anything if you just look at one trace when they press the button, because it's too noisy. There's all sorts of stuff going on. But if you get them to press the button 100 times, then what you get is this signal that builds up before up to a second before the button press, and then collapses, actually begin to collapse just before the button press. And that they call the readiness potential. So the question is, what does that mean? What is going on when there's a signal which on average builds up before you perform a spontaneous action? And what Benjamin Libet did, and this has been done in many different ways since then, is he had a slightly more complex task where there was a
clock-like figure in front of a subject with a sort of second hand rotating quite quickly, about once a second or so. And people had to say where the clock hand was at the moment when they felt that they had committed themselves to press the button. Okay. So you're pressing the button when you feel like it, and you're doing it many times, and each time you do that, because there are some seconds between the presses by arrangement, the clock face is spinning around and you say, ah, it was at 2 o'clock when I felt I was committed. When you do that, what happens, is that subjects feel they're committed rather shortly, maybe 150 or so milliseconds before the movement begins. And quite a long time after this build-up starts. So, this paper was published with quite a lot of commentary on it as incorporated. So there were two papers. There was the original paper and there was a commentary paper. And some people said, ah, this is the nail in the death of the nail in the coffin of free will. The brain has decided before you know that you're going to make the button press, that you're going to make it. And the experiment has been done more carefully than Libet did it, but the result isn't wildly different. Now, this is still a controversial experiment in all its forms, and I could take you through the various sophistications of it, but I don't think it will really help, because the key issues are quite simple. One of them is a bit technical. Scientists looking at behavior normally like to have a comparison. So what you'd really like here is two variants of the experiment, one of which is just as I described, and the other of which was by some means you arrange that the subject cancelled the movement shortly after they would have otherwise made it. So people have done a number of experiments like that, and they've asked, or the other way you can do it is you can have two buttons, and you can say press the left or the right one, and you then look at when you get a differential signal depending whether they pressed the right or left one.
Could I just ask? Yeah. I mean, it struck me that preliminary stuff is, it could be in cases where you were about to do it but didn't do it. So if that's the case, if you look at the trace, can you actually see situations where this happened but didn't?
Okay, here is the problem. You cannot see individual trials in this experiment because there's so much random activity.
Right. But it could be that.
Yes. There is a problem with whether you can argue from the average to what was happening on individual trials. So if you do that, if you make it a choice time, or if you make a cancellation, a choice task or a cancellation, then you don't get as big a difference between when the signal starts and the time that the subjects feel it, that they're committing themselves. Another way of thinking about it is it's known from a lot of work on motor control that supposing what you do is you ask somebody to follow a leaping spot with their eyes. So you're looking at a spot here and it suddenly goes over here and then it pops over here. And all they've got to do is follow it. Well, what do they do when you go, something blinks over here and then it comes up there? Well, sometimes what they do is they cancel that movement altogether and go straight to the other one. So you can infer from observations like that but there's a time delay involved in cancelling a previously arranged program of action.
So one interpretation of this experiment that I personally quite like is that how should a subject know when they decided to press a button? That's not something we need to know. It's a slightly artificial task. So maybe what the subject's really telling you is not, as Libet put it, when they felt the urge to move, but when they realized that the program was sufficiently far along they couldn't stop it. And that would be just about right, about 150 milliseconds before action. We know it is difficult not to stop pre-programming. So that's the gist of it. So you can almost take a choice now. You can say, I would say that this is an inherently ambiguous experiment for the following reason, and for a generalizable reason. It's only simple to interpret if you know that this readiness potential is a kind of properly equivalent physical measure to the process of making a commitment to a piece of action. And that's just what you don't know. All you know is that it's a temporally related event. So I think this is mostly a precautionary tale about the difficulties of arguing from a correlation between events in time that may have other explanations. And the one about it being the signals being average turns out to be very important. And there are recent experiments I won't go into that suggest that the fact that different things are happening on different trials may be part of the story. There's a little bit more detail. And don't worry about the exact times because it depends how you do the experiment. Now,
could I ask you that one, the key?
Yes.
It's half a second.
So this is half a second before the beginning of the movement, and that could be judged most technically by when the muscle signals start. That's the best way of doing it. You get the signal begin to build up, and the time of awareness to urge to move is the standard figure in rigid experiments for 160 milliseconds, but that's an average of subjects, of course. Okay. Now, I don't want you to go away with the idea that there isn't mechanistic thinking about these things that is uncontroversial. If I put you in my laboratory and I have you watching a spot of light, and there's a ring of other spots of lights that can come up, and your task is just to look at them as quickly as you can, as promptly as you can. And I play with things like the probabilities of where the targets are and so on. You can tease out a lot of interesting things about how you do not a spontaneous movement like that, but a reaction to a simple stimulus. Actually, if you just have two targets, you're watching one and another one comes on, you don't move your eyes or move your finger, if you're doing it with your fingers, at exactly the same time every time. There's variability, that's biology. But there's something more interesting to that. The histogram of the response times is not normal. And it's not normal in the way that rather long delays are more common than they would be in a normal or Gaussian response. There's a long tail falling off. And people have known this for a very long time. And a colleague in Cambridge called Roger Carpenter actually did this as a lab experiment for students originally. He thought, well, I wonder what this means. And what he noticed was if you don't plot, I'm sorry I haven't got the figures for this, if you don't plot the reaction times
distribution is a function of time, but of the reciprocal of time, then the distribution curve is normal. It's quite accurately normal for eye movements, arm movements, everything. So there's something special about the reciprocal of reaction time, which produces symmetrical normal distributions. And that's actually quite easy to explain, because if you imagine a very simple mechanism that when you're trying to do something, there's a signal that is growing at a certain rate and it has to reach a threshold, okay? Then the faster it grows, the quicker it will reach the threshold. But the relationship between how long it takes to reach the threshold and the rate at which it's rising is non-linear, because it's approximately reciprocal. So you can model all this reaction time behavior with a very simple internal model where you can think of some process in the brain as setting off a signal that rises at a constant rate. That rate is randomly variable, and that will then give you these peculiar distributed histograms. And there's far more to this story than I've shown. It follows Bayesian statistical principles and so on. So I'm not saying that you can't tell some kind of story about mechanistic processes in human reactions. You can. Now I want to change gear quite substantially and explain. I can't answer any of the big questions, but explain where I think that some of the dead ends are. See, this whole Libet experiment is really thinking in what would be called a Cartesian framework, which is where you imagine actions being decided upon by some kind of internal real us and then passed on to the brain to execute. And one term for this,
amongst philosophers who don't like it, this is Anthony Kenny, it is the homunculus fallacy, the idea that there's something inside us, soul or mind or whatever, that is the source of our ability to behave. And the problem with that is very simple, that whatever explanatory difficulties there are in explaining why we do anything are still there in respect of why the mind or the soul does it. So it's an explanation that doesn't achieve anything. It does no philosophical work. And that you may be uncomfortable with, but I would say that's a very broadly accepted point amongst neuroscientists of the old school. Now, I'm still with philosophers now. This is also Kenny. I'm trying to convince you that the idea that we make a decision and then we do something is not actually a very accurate description of what we do. In other words, that the standard model associated with Cartesian thinking in some sense is rather odd. If you're writing a thank you letter, we might actually think what we're going to say and then write it down, or actually we might just pick up the piece of paper and start writing. I bet there are people who've done letters both ways, or always do it one way, some of us do it another way. And actually lots of actions are like this. There isn't a clearly separable decision to do something and just starting it. And lots of our mental life is like this. We don't sit down and think to have an idea occurs to us. Even when we make quite a complex decision, maybe a very important decision about career or choice of partner and so on, you know, we may be
like the proverbial geek can make a list of good points, bad points, you know, and so on. But often the process of making a decision is not something that you can actually describe in any precision. It's something that happens. So what am I trying to say here? I think that there's a flawed way of thinking about how action generally proceeds behind the logic of the Libet experiment, and it is more or less the Cartesian assumption. I'm now going to go on to some rather broader issues to do with determinism. This is a little book by Anthony Kenny some years ago called The Metaphysics of Mind. And it's called The Metaphysics of Mind as a sort of deference to a man called Ryle, who wrote a very influential book with a similar title some years before, but Kenny's book is rather more subtle. Now here's a kind of determinism which is very often mentioned. So we say the reason we did something was because we wanted to, and that the because is a cause. So the difficulty with that really springs out of the point I've just made, which is there doesn't need to be any clear separation between, there doesn't need to be a separable process of making a decision and doing something. And if there isn't, then it cannot be the case that we do something because we want to, because there may never be a definable prior want. Is what I mean. Maybe that's a bit too subtle. I haven't put it well. So, I'm moving really towards now how I think about the issue. So, and this owes a lot to Donald Mackay, although it's 25 years since he died. And what Mackay urged us to do was to try to hang on to the idea that we have two kinds of data streams, if you like, about who we are. We have a first-person perspective, and incidentally nowadays you could talk about a second-person perspective as well, you know, what other people tell us. And you have the sort of perspective that a scientific observer, in principle detached from us, could tell us about what's going on, particularly in our brains. And supposing we just say, why should we actually rubbish either of those points of view? Why should we not accept all of those data as data? That then the problem really resolves to what do we make of the correlations between the two, and if the correlations are very good, what are the implications? And I think when Mackay first proposed this, it was a position which had to be carefully defended. I would say that broadly speaking, with the collapse of strict behaviorism in neuroscience and the admission to science of the reports of the subject and the observations of the subject in a broader way, this has become somewhat more acceptable, although there's still a tendency to feel that the real data are the observer's data, which I think is a mistake.
The observer's data can be much more precise.
It depends what you mean by
in time,
precise.
Time-wise, that's fine.
Depends what you mean by precise. Depends what you want to know about.
So, what I'm trying to do in this quote here is really, this is another point from Kenny,
which is to deal with one other confusion, which is, if we're talking about the possibility that there's a deterministic explanation of what we do and do not do, then one point that isn't going to work is to say that, but I do what I want to do. Because, as Kenny puts it, slightly more lengthened in the quote, if the physiological determinism is, if you like, well constructed, then inter alia, it will be the case that we want what we do. So I think that the idea that you get when people talk about the latest bit of neuroscience, that here are some observations on the brain showing us that we that there's a separation between what we want to do and what our brain is telling us are suspect, because that is a better way of describing it would be that perhaps the brain data suggests that we as a whole are more divided about what we want to do than is apparent. And I don't see any reason why that shouldn't be the case. I've taken about, I've taken too much time really. I'm just going to have a quick, I'm going to move forward a little bit here. I've slightly lost my train of thought here. And how about at this point I stop and we throw it open to questions and I'll see if I can pick up where you're at rather than the rather esoteric places I've tried to go and I'm getting the sense that I'm not carrying you with me. Okay, thank you very much.
Personally, that Stuart knows that so I was involved in a group trying to tackle this question, and it's a labyrinth, it really is. And that Stuart, you've done such a good job trying to.
Well, I think I was over ambitious, but please fire questions at me. I'll probably be able to answer some of the questions better than.
In the experiment where the person was pressing the button,
yes,
and you had the time, you showed the time going up, peaking, and
yes.
They press it. If they do it the first time, and then when they get to 99, the 99th time, is there a difference in the time?
You can't see those signals.
Can you just repeat the question?
Yes, so the question was, when you do the button pressing task and you record the readiness potential, is the readiness signal different on the first press and the last press? The answer is you don't know. Because these signals are so small that on a trial pace basis, they're invisible. But it may be there are ways to tease out data, but I don't know the answer.
I've read that this is for years half, and it always seemed to be fairly absurd to talk about it being about what I want to do.
Yeah.
Because I don't want to press that button.
No.
You want me to press this button.
Yes.
You want me to press this button according to some set of rules, and I'm trying to follow your rules.
Did people hear the question? So that's a very good point. There's a whole other level of criticism about this experiment, as essentially it's an inappropriate model for decisions that we care about. I think what many scientists would say to that is, well, you have to start somewhere.
and this was where the subject started. But I agree with you. I actually don't think it matters. I mean, supposing we did a task like that by, in effect, starting a random number generator in our head and forgetting about it, would it really matter? I think nobody would care about it. So nothing hinges on the outcome of this experiment, it seems to me, but you wouldn't think that from the noise that some people have made about it. They regard it, you see, if you like, the standard skeptical, skeptic in the sense of skeptical about human freedom take on it is, well, the brain organizes everything we do and kind of reports it to consciousness when it feels like it. So actually what that kind of view is philosophically, it's as a kind of inverted Cartesian dualism, where instead of having the soul doing everything that matters, you've got the brain doing everything that matters, and our common sense self being irrelevant. So, and that is, that's an objection that some philosophers have made, which is this is a kind of backdoor Cartesianism, but it's a difficult point to make because neuroscientists tend to think the brain is where everything happens. And in a sense, it's true if you're looking at the transactional analysis that they are of electrical signal, I am, electrical signals. But it isn't true in a broader perspective. Here's a really wild, if you like science fiction. We're all used to wireless controls. So suppose a future experiment in which what happens is I'm an aging scientist. My brain is taken out and put into a robot, and there's a whole lot of wireless controls so that, you know, I have visual inputs and sensory inputs, the brain and so on, and motor outputs are also wireless. And suppose actually all the wireless signals get confused so that I end up having, you know, visual signals from Oxford and my motor commands are in Bristol and so on, then it becomes incoherent. So what the take-home message of that is, if you think about it, is the brain itself is not quite where we're at, even on the nuts and bolts level, because you're presuming the brain is connected in the normal way into a world, and if you go on with the analogy, into world, the world of other human beings or things like human beings. So it isn't really the brain. So if you like, the brain is a conduit through which everything is happening, but it isn't the brain in isolation, because it never is in isolation. Okay.
Just a few observations on a question. It struck me that when you started talking about freedom, like freedom of a slave, yes, it's a very different sort of freedom, yes, from the freedom to decide, because the slave has freedom to have his opinions about things and all sorts of things which are not, which he would like to do, all sorts of things. He's enslaved physically, but not mentally, it seems to me, or not necessarily mentally. It strikes me that what you're doing borders on the whole idea of consciousness and the what consciousness is, and perhaps neuroscience can't yet help very much about that, because when you're talking about free will, you're talking about, it's related to this I, thou and I, it perception, I think, if you look from that outside as an observer, or you look internally of what you are yourself, it's a very different sort of world. But when you've got through all this stuff, the business of whether you have free will or not has all sorts of ethical implications and social implications. Mm-hmm. And I think at the end there you sort of got a bit of biblical stuff, but on one of your slides I thought I glanced at it. Could you sort of cut through all this sort of the detail and say what you think,
okay,
about that sort of thing?
No, I lost my way in technicalities. I think it's a mistake to hand this problem to the philosophers.
Mm.
Because if you think practically, What matters is the extent to which we are influenced by factors we're unaware of, and influences that are unfortunate, and the extent to which those can be overcome. And I would say, if we start from Judeo-Christian fundamentals, that the answer to that kind of question is going to take us outside the sphere of the isolated individual. So, because I had, you know, Jesus's summary of the law up there, because the crux of how to live is there are only two things that matter: to love God himself, and that of course means including loving truth, and to love your neighbor as yourself. So I think it could be true that if I've come from a very damaged background, it's extraordinarily difficult for me to make good decisions about certain things. But what that doesn't mean is if other people are willing to come alongside me and be my brothers and sisters and help me relearn some of those bad responses, it doesn't mean that those can't be overcome. Or there might be cases where it does. So I think we're invited to, if you like, a living experiment to find out how much of the disentangled evil that has happened in all our lives can be undone by loving our neighbour as ourselves. And the reason we can't... I mean, I'm a Calvinist at heart. I think God in his sovereignty probably does see the whole picture, and there's nothing that happens without his will, but that is not something we can ever see. And from our perspective, our job is to find out what can be put right both common grace and his spirit. And if you like, practically explore the limits to our freedom. So maybe I betray the fact that I've been married to an Oriental woman for 30 years, and I'm actually sort of shying off the hard intellectual questions and going more for practical.
Yes, you mentioned that Calvinist viewpoint then. It sounded sort of straight away to me as if that's something quite close to the Islamic faith, because they are extremely fatalist. Although the play as a whole isn't for the things you were suggesting then, like an experiment to see if we can get towards more good happening. It's different. That part is different in Islam, but the Calvinist thing you just mentioned there, which is very sort of fatalistic, like God does actually know everything.
I don't think Calvin was a fatalist. I think he had and Luther too, for that matter, had a very high view of God's sovereignty and power. So, I mean, Ernest will put me right if I said put my foot in too many Calvats here, but I think you're in difficulty once you say things can happen that are outside God's control. We've moved into a different theological framework. So I'm happy to stick with God is completely sovereign, and it's hard to understand how we can nevertheless be reasonably asked to get on with.
The problem of evil has also become very big.
Yes. Because what is the alternative? The alternative, it seems to me, is to say, well, God messes up, which is close to saying, well, God isn't completely God. So, and I know people have gone that way, and I have colleagues who've gone that way, but so...
That's the New Reach Book Dilemma, is it? The problem is God either has, if God is or not,
yes.
And this place.
So, I suppose I see a kind of... We must not forget that God is, in our formal language, is infinite and all-knowing, and that is... And we are not. There are severe limitations even to our most brilliant accomplishments. So it doesn't worry me at all that God may be able to see the whole picture as present, if you like. What can't be true, although Luther went so far as to say that when God urges us to do good, he knows we can't. And it's all right. He still has to tell us that we can't do it without him. I'm not sure that's right. So there are puzzles in that, yes. I haven't solved anything, I'm sorry. Yes.
Isn't part of the issue that sometimes when we try and engage with these issues, we try to use Greek logic? And when the Bible was written with Hebraic logic, so we're trying to look at things with linear logic rather than circular logic?
I have a lot of sympathy with that. I think the difficulty is, and I'm following other people in this, first of all, there isn't really one Greek position. The part of the marvel of Greeks was they're able to have so many different competing ideas of practical realization. So I think when talks about the influence of Greek thought on Christian theology, it's primarily the influence of Neoplatonism through Augustine, what one's talking about. I hear what you're saying. I don't feel I have the expertise to make a specific comment to it. But the reason I had the Shema there was, I think we need to go back to basics.
Do we have a little quick break and then more Q&A or what?
Sally, what's the tea situation? Are you able to... What's the time now?
22.
We're quite early, aren't we? Because Stuart's got to catch the train at 10 to 10, so we've got plenty of time. Is it urn hot at all? Is that what you're wanting?
Is it
hot tea? No. There's loads of cake,
I
should
imagine.
We
don't have it.
We spent all day baking
for that. Okay. I mean, if you want me just to talk about straight neuroscience, I can tell you other fascinating things.
Yeah.
Here's a nice experiment.
You know those ghastly moral conundrums that you probably got in school if you went to that kind of high school? You're in a lifeboat and there are 12 people in a lifeboat for 8 people and it's about to founder and there's one very sick person who probably won't survive. Should you throw them out? Knowing they will certainly die, you increase the chance of everybody else dying. But there's no right answer to that. It's quite close to a decision that captains of ships at sea in war had to take and did take, which is a couple of people go overboard, you know, or some small boat is in difficulty. Should they stop and pick them up? The enemy submarine will probably catch them if they do. And my understanding is that most captains could have said, no, you don't. You have far greater concern for your 1,000 people on the ship. But those are difficult decisions to make. Philosophers can argue about how to dissect that kind of conundrum, but let's just call it a utilitarian or a compassionate direction you could go. And there are probably more dimensions in that. If you look at people with damage to part of the prefrontal cortex, sort of roughly speaking, above the arms. And you're very careful to select just the right group of people, that you can find a group of people with lots of other symptoms of certain rigidities in their thinking, but amongst other things, they make much, much more utilitarian decisions in those kind of problems than most people do, you know, controls with brain damage elsewhere.
Well, Phineas Gage with the rail spike through his head was mentioned on questions.
Well, so it's a much more refined version of Phineas Gage, yes. So there's an indication that the integrity of a little bit of the brain up here seems to bias people in a direction to making, and then the debate starts. What is it? Is it that they're less sensitive to the fact that they're seeing somebody off to death, or is it that the whole thing is more rigid? So it's difficult to interpret, but and there are lots of observations like that now showing that quite subtle behaviour can be disturbed after damage to different parts of the brain. I'm not going to go into imaging because it's so hard to interpret the imaging studies.
Stuart?
Yeah.
Sorry, can I come in one
second?
Yeah. I was just going to come just explore more this idea of the first person, third person.
Yes. Okay.
Because there's one, I mean, I remember at A level, I was in the physics class and I was the only girl, and all the boys were just sort of getting really philosophical, and they're existentialists. So basically, the idea that the only thing you can be sure of is, you know, what you yourself. Can perceive, and I kind of saw the point really, because basically we are inside these brains. I mean, I don't know how it works.
No.
All we receive is sight, hearing.
All right. I put it to you that this is a story that most of us learned, and it isn't right because.
And the various tricky arguments, I probably won't get quite right for this, but let's take a particular example. When I say I'm in pain, I'm reporting a private feeling of myself that is only known to me. Now, there's a famous counter argument from modern philosophy. And he invites us to consider, supposing I say, I'm in pain. It's really, really painful. And my right foot is agonizing. It's absolutely agonizing. By the way, I've just come in from playing cricket today. And so on. You say, so I keep saying that I'm in pain, but I display none of a very large number of things that would normally happen with pain. Now, it is just possible that I have some bizarre brain damage which has produced a very strange abnormal situation. But it's much more likely that the part of the meaning of any word, even one which appears to refer to a private experience, is actually public. And if it wasn't, how could children ever learn it? How would a child ever learn to know what the word pain meant if there wasn't an external equivalent of it? So
that's only because we're all built quite similarly, so we experience the same kind of sensations. So we can talk about something that we all experience, but it's still, we're only judging what is actually coming into our brains. We can't...
What I'm saying is that's not the way that modern philosophers think about it, or at least not the ones I follow. So what we're doing when we go your way is we're thinking in a dualist fashion. But if you say, how do we know that it's like that, then it would make much more sense to say, no, actually this whole realm of having a discussion, talk, words, symbols, that's inherently between people. It's not something that can ever happen, probably can never happen with an individual person. I mean, obviously it can happen with a... In origin, this ability to speak to one another about all sorts of things, including our own internal state in some sense, it must have grown up as a... It only has meaning. Sorry, I'm overstating the case now, but that's my take on that.
What do modern philosophers say?
This is a particular stream of modern philosophy. This is the later Wittgenstein.
So they say what?
Philosophy and history in that tradition.
So just to say, we can now have some more tea and coffee, should we wish. Should we say 10 minutes and then?
Andrew, have a question.
Yeah.
Well, do you want me to wait till afterwards?
Well, let's just let people sort of get some tea and coffee, and then we'll restart in 10 minutes.
Sorry. It gives me an opportunity to ask the question which I didn't get before. Actually, it's not so much a question as, well, it is in a sense, I'd be interested to know your view on what I find very helpful in this area, but you may tell me that it's completely heretical. So my way of thinking, if you consider the brain as an organ like the computer hardware, then whatever inputs you put in, depending on the program, you get predictable outcomes. Now, the question to me is, what is the program that runs in our brain? And that's what I would call the soul. Now, I know that in a sense it's separating the two, but to what extent does that solve a lot of problems? Because we all have different programs. So we will all make slightly different decisions. And that's what makes us. It's the program that's unique. And of course, if the brain goes wrong, as with a computer, it's part of the brain goes wrong, then all the outputs work properly. So how do you respond to that? I mean, how do you respond to that as an analogy? Can I ask you to quiet down a bit of back, please?
Okay, so the question is the analogy that the brain is like the computer hardware and the mind or soul is like the software helpful? I used to think this was the case, and I think it still has its uses if very carefully put. So, for example, the hardware in a computer is deterministic, or a conventional computer. There's nothing uncertain about it. But what happens is significant at the level of what program is running and what the program needs. So, and that's, of course, partly because a computer is, by definition, a kind of universal machine. I think the extent to which it's not helpful is there isn't really a clear separation of hardware and software in brain. So, you know, for example, if you take the sort of main assumption of modern neuroscience, the working assumption that there is some kind of correlate in brain activity to any aspect of our first-person experience, then I think it's extremely likely that that's got to include things like conditional effects. You know, what would happen if there were an altered signal in this part of the brain? So in other words, what the state of all the synaptic strengths is, and so on. So those are, if you like, hardware changes brought about by, if you want to call it experience, programming. So it becomes difficult to push very hard.
But you...
And the other problem, of course, is that there's a problem with individuality, because you can take the program and you can run it on any hardware.
No, that's what I'm saying. We each have our individual program. That is, I mean, the question is really, what is the soul, isn't it? I mean, in the sense of what makes you, makes me. And that's what I suppose I would see as the program.
Somebody wants to...
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not a neuroscientist, but my interpretation would be that the brain is a collection of atoms, and that forms, if you like, a sort of hardware. However, the chemical and electrical impulses that occur in your brain also are the result of...
That experiment, the second one, was that in terms of the technical techniques that were used? Was that single neuron?
None of this was single neurons, although the Libet experiment has been done with neuronal data, and I haven't got the right slides to talk about that. But the main discussion is always about the human experiment, because it's there may be a human recording experiment now. I must look for that. So I don't know the answer to that. I'm sorry.
And I'm just wondering, in terms of just maybe a bit holistically on the subjectivity versus that subjective approach to what, versus the objective approach. If we look at the image of God, like the man, you mentioned that we are the byproducts sometimes of the decisions that we make, might be affected by the fashion, the history, human history, genetics. So it's sort of, I can see an accumulative, I'm sorry if I'm putting words in the mouth, but my interpretation is that there's an accumulative language coming through, like standing on the shoulders of the giants, and that kind of thing. If you look at it maybe as one consciousness, then that would have one free will, which has put maybe kind of the image of God, and then because we are children of God, and we are potentially that infinity, we, it's that consciousness manifesting in our plane of consciousness a certain time or space, and that's what makes us decide. I'm not sure if I'm putting
I think I can
and
see.
And when you said like, we are body of Christ, also in Bible.
As I understand you, you're going in a direction that's in English history, the Quakers, right, the Religious Society of Friends, which is to emphasise the image of God in terms of there being something holy and pure inside each of us. The theological tradition, it, sort of going from St. Augustine, Luther, Calvin and the Protestant reformers has generally been rather doubtful about that. They've tended to emphasise the fallenness of man apart from the work of the Holy Spirit. So the fallenness, you know, the inherent evil in humans. So that's the division of opinion.
So like the potential to become like God, but we are sinners because we always fall short in becoming that whole.
But that's what we're invited to, of course. In renewed in Christ, we are invited to join him as younger children, adopted into Heavenly Father's family, or adopted as full sons and daughters. Yeah.
I'm going to take people who haven't, there's one over here, and then there's one there. I'm going to try and take questions, one there, that people haven't asked before. So, over.
If I understand it correctly, many scientists would argue that the brain is deterministic, but free will is a it emerges out of the complexity of the deterministic process. So, for example, whatever the neurons firing in my brain do is deterministic, but I am drinking a cup of tea because I boiled the water because I switched the kettle on. The free will consists of the I choose to make a cup of tea, therefore I switch, put water in the kettle and boil it. All the stuff that's going on in my brain is deterministic, but I'm freely choosing to make a cup of tea. And then that's, so it's an emergent property.
I'd say that is a position that has been more commonly put clearly by the opponents of neuroscience. But I think there's truth in that. But there's also difficulty in what you mean by deterministic. Because when you start thinking carefully about what you mean by you live in a deterministic universe, what you end up talking about is a model. And you really don't know how accurately that model applies. First of all, because of quantum mechanics. So there's a fundamental uncertainty about whether there is exact anything. And secondly, because even if we lived in a Laplacian universe, you know, where everything was a particle and every particle had an exact position and it all went forward like clockwork, actually you can't predict a part of that, because you don't know that you've got part of the universe that will never react with the rest of it. So, I mean, to take a practical example, you can't predict, you'll never be able to predict what human life will be like in a million years' time, because that probably depends on you know, what's happening on the other side of the universe. If it is all very finely balanced, as it would have to be in a completely deterministic scheme. So these are sketchy arguments, but I think that there's a lot of imprecise thinking about what we mean by a strictly deterministic scheme, and that the practical question is rather different, which is how strong are the factors that, how large are the probabilities linking one event to another?
I don't think that's...
Sorry, I'll get this. Could be quite strict. You had your hand up and then go behind.
When I was studying engineering at university, we had a few lectures on, I suppose, what you might call very basic science. The objective being to see if you can use mathematical models and technical models to, at the very least, mimic brain activity, if not explain it, but model it and mimic it. And an example of that is, for example, using Bayesian mathematics to program a computer to learn based on its past experience. So firstly, to what extent do you think those models are useful in understanding the brain, and more specifically, do you think the brain is actually just a decision maker based on all of its past experiences and sort of Bayesian?
I have this much sympathy with dualism that I think the brain doesn't do those things. It isn't the right kind of object to make decisions. So I think to spell out the question the way I would want to spell it out, if we look at the nuts and bolts of what's going on in the brain, are there processes that can be interpreted as underlying us making a quasi-Bayesian estimate of what's likely to happen? Sure. So, you look best. Okay, well, what would it mean by saying that a nerve cell thinks? It would have to mean that it can make a decision of its own. Well, that doesn't happen. What would it mean by saying 20 nerve cells made an estimate? It's what older philosophers called a category error, that you're using language that only applies at one level to another level where it doesn't strictly apply. It's a subtle point, but we'll talk about it afterwards.
There's one here first, and then we'll have you at the back there.
I just want to bring it up on one idea that I got. Returning to the point of the hardware and the software.
Yeah.
From my point of view, the hardware, it's like the brain, and the software is like the idea. But there is one thing that it we miss out, but it is the person that it is playing with the computer. Because if you don't have this person, nothing really happens. It is just the computer, and it is just the hardware. So the software. So the software is like the ideas. If you put a baby in the jungle, the baby doesn't have any idea. Doesn't have the idea that it is baby have in the city. If you have a lot of ideas, and the thing is that I think that the free will that has this person is outside the range that the science can achieve, because the science can see can measure the screen, can measure the computer, can see that hardware, but cannot achieve that it is the soul, that it is the person who is playing with the computer. I don't know if you agree with that idea or not.
Not sure I entirely follow you, but my I was trying to think about two things at once, and the result is
you're saying there's almost a third level. So we've got the program, the hardware, and the input from the
software is like the ideas, but we need to put in order our ideas and our will to put in order that idea, because we have different passions, but we are problems, and it is our will.
I think the thing I probably should have said that I didn't say is there's a huge amount of evidence from the study of people with brain damage that shows that whereas it is possible to sustain very substantial brain damage with remarkable preservation, it's not the typical outcome, but normally if we damage the bits of the brain, it will have consequences that are very far-reaching, would go well into the realms of thinking in many cases. So, let me give you a specific example. I had a nasty bike accident some years ago, and I noticed afterwards that when I was looking at the hob, which had the various burners and then a row of knobs, whereas before I didn't have to think about which knob related to which burner, I had to actually think about it then. So there'd been some subtle change to my ability to put together spatial arrangements. Now, that probably means I had a little bit of frontal parietal damage, at least in the classical neurological way of thinking about it.
Yes. Just one more thing. If you have brain damage, or you have, alcohol, and you change your behavior, it means that the computer is not working properly. But you are the same. You are trying to put the computer in the right place, but you are not
capable. No, it's not that simple. Suppose you have a child that's grown up in an abusive family, but not a family so abusive they've actually had their head banged against the wall. So it's been more lack of love, lots of verbal abuse, and so on. It's not that they've, maybe their brains have developed in some way abnormally, but it's not there's been any physical brain damage. It's that the experience has, from what we know, probably built in psychological problems.
We better make it last.
I would say we just brought up the problem of experience, and yeah. I was trying to relate that with the earlier existential problem of personal knowledge and the ability to make decisions. But because I've already talked about that, I'll move on. In terms of our free will and being able to make choices, for example, at the moment I'm making a choice to ask you a question.
Yes.
Is that necessarily determined by something that is happening in my brain? Is it necessary that some nervous connections have taken place, or electrical connections in my brain have already taken place before I choose to ask the question? That's one part. The other part, having studied all those years of neuroscience, what makes you choose to believe that free will is not an illusion?
Okay, good one, finish off.
Okay. I think I would say to your first question, I'm not sure it matters if there is a mechanistic story, because it's not the right level of analysis. It may be that in a different universe with all the same human beings in it, including you and I, you would not have asked the question. There are all sorts of reasons why it's very unlikely there's going to be a clear-cut relationship between anything you can measure in your brain and
and whether or not you actually asked a question. However, just before you're going to ask it, then it may be high probabilities. Your heart rate begins to rise a little bit if you find it scary, or it doesn't if you don't. The second question, I'm not sure how much free will I have. I'm quite sure that I've been given responsibility. So the problem I have is really how to understand where responsibility fits in to the story, because I do not know if I had had different parents and I had had different experience in life, whether I would have done different things. It's unknowable, but so in a sense I'm agnostic about whether there is some, if you like, causal path behind the decisions I make. I do think I'm responsible for them, and that's the part that I don't know how to flesh it out, except that it seems to me that that is through and through part of what Christians and Jews have always believed, which is that we're in a universe. He's given human beings some capacities which are a faint echo of his own, to look after the world we're in and to look after one another. So how could we not have responsibility? But whether we're absolutely free, I doubt. I think what matters is something more nuanced, which is how much we can actually help other people get out of the various binds that they're in, Christianly speaking, through sin and its pervasive effects, and Satan and his work.
That's a great note to finish on. I'm reminded that it's some part of Shakespeare, isn't it? There's more to life than is thought of in your philosophy, Horatio. One of the things I'm quite convinced of is that we're never going to get to the bottom of it. But let's give a round of applause, so thank you very much.
Could I say you're a very generous audience, and I'm sorry that I didn't do a better job of the kind of formal part of the talk.